Hello, happy Thursday. It's the NPR News Update with Minnesota's news on your schedule. I'm Phil Picardi. On today's menu, the Minneapolis PD addresses allegations of racism within the department. Minorities want a bigger stake in the new St. Paul baseball stadium. Light rail planners say a proposed Southwest Metro line is chugging along, but slowly. Simple solutions can be employed to address health care gaps. And on the eve of football, Chris Carter talks about catching passes in Minnesota. First, 8 people were hurt and 1 woman had to be airlifted to the hospital after a bull escaped from a rodeo at the Dakota County Fair last night. Tim Nelson has more.
That's fairgoers cheering a rodeo rider that chased down and roped a rampaging bull from a YouTube video shot at the fair near Farmington last night. The animal got loose shortly after 8 o'clock, escaped the rodeo fence, and ran through thousands of people gathered at the fair. The bull ran down 8 people, including a Dakota County Sheriff's deputy that shot the animal twice to no effect. Sheriff Dave Bellows said the animal apparently broke open a gate holding cattle for the fair's annual rodeo night. Video from the incident shows it running through the fairgrounds for about 5 minutes, pursued by mounted rodeo riders, a squad car, and people on foot. The sheriff said the rest of the injured people suffered only minor injuries and were treated by paramedics at the fair. Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Minneapolis Police Chief Janae Harto convened a new Citizens Advisory Council yesterday. The group will recommend systemic departmental changes. Rupa Shenoy reports.
The meeting came in response to several recent racially charged incidents involving Minneapolis police officers. Harto says she apologized and allowed community leaders to vent during the 90-minute private discussion. Bishop Richard Howell of Shiloh Temple says Harto didn't try to justify the actions of her officers.
The dialogue was very transparent and candid. We did not mince our words, but at the end of the day, we left this meeting with the greatest hope we can have at this time, and we're very encouraged, highly encouraged, that change is coming.
The group emerged with a plan for subcommittees to develop recommendations for improving the department's community engagement, recruiting, training, and accountability. Harto says the whole group will come back together in the third week of September to create a master action plan. Rupa Shenoy, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Police Lieutenant John Delmonico is the president of the Minneapolis Police Officers Federation, a union representing more than 800 officers in Minneapolis. He was at Chief Harto's meeting yesterday, and he talked with Kathy Werzer on Morning Edition.
How would you describe the tone of yesterday's meeting?
You know, healthy. I think it was a chance for community leaders and police officers to kind of voice things they've heard, things they've felt from both inside the department and the community.
Now, evidently, changes will be recommended to training and hiring and accountability, as I mentioned. What message does the union have for these folks working on these issues as they start crafting the proposals?
Well, I mean, fortunately, I'm going to be at the table, so I always appreciate that. And I think it's not just, you know, what are we going to do different? I think a big piece for the police department is to explain to the community how we do things. And then certainly it's always good to look at, is there things you can do to do better? Is it an education piece for the police department to educate the community? So I think the dialogue is always good.
And some of that dialogue may be a bit uncomfortable for some of the officers. Now, as you know, the chief has asked officers to speak up if they hear or see racism among their colleagues. Do you think it's realistic to ask officers to police each other in that way?
Well, you know, one thing I brought up yesterday at the meeting, and, you know, the perception is, you know, this wall of silence and cops don't police themselves very well. And I really disagree with that. And our Internal Affairs Unit in 2012, about half the complaints that came into Internal Affairs about cops were from other cops.
The chief has said that training won't make racist cops not racist. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I do.
So then what can be done to keep racist attitudes out of the department?
Well, you know, I mean, we hire from the human race. So will we ever, you know, rid the department of people that can be problems? I don't think so. But I think, you know, it's things she's talking about. Who do we hire? You know, how do we train those people? You know, what are the clear expectations set out by her? You know, is there consistent accountability in the department? You know, I think there's lots of things that are in place now that do work.
In the past, as you know, the union's butted heads with other police chiefs. Do you think Chief Hartow is the person to get the job done when it comes to changing the department?
You know, Janae, you know, since starting to take over, has done a really good job of connecting with the cops, connecting with the community. You know, years ago we had the Police Community Relations Council, which I was part of for 5 years. It was some really good dialogue with the community. That kind of disappeared under Chief Dolan. And even prior to, you know, what's come up recently, Chief Hartow has always said, you know, we need dialogue. Dialogue from her to the police, dialogue from the police to the community, dialogue from the community back to the police. So I think, you know, like I said, it's always healthy in any relationships that you can sit down and talk to each other.
As you know, Lieutenant Delmonico, there's been a lot of dialogue over a lot of years, and perceptions of racism in parts of the Minneapolis Police Department are really nothing new, as you know. Do you see anything different or more urgent about this moment compared to times in the past?
No, I don't. You know, there's always been times where there's been specific incidents that come up that are big incidents, that are concerning incidents. But the one thing that I think that is always forgotten in this is the many, many good things that the Minneapolis police do every day. Last year, our cops responded to almost 500,000 calls for service. So almost a 500,000 times last year, people picked up the phone, they needed something, and they called the Minneapolis Police Department. And we responded. And I think totally there was less than 200 complaints filed against the police department. So, yes, we do have some days, bad days, but I think they're far and few in between. And it certainly, our good days outnumber the bad days.
All right. Lieutenant Delmonico, thanks for the conversation.
Werzer and John Delmonico from Morning Edition. Builders of the new St. Stadium in St. Paul's Lowertown neighborhood say they want about a third of the 500 construction jobs to go to women and people of color. It's a goal aimed at closing the employment gap. We go back to Tim Nelson for a report.
Calvin Littlejohn runs Minneapolis-based Tri Construction. It's one of the two firms working right now on the Saints ballpark project in St. Paul, along with Ryan Construction. But Littlejohn says he's building more than a stadium in Lowertown.
Understand that. Us being a small African-American-owned construction company located within the metro area, we see the demographics and also understand the whole plight of how a lack of jobs impacts our community.
Recent studies by the Washington-based Economic Policy Institute show black workers in the Twin Cities have three times the unemployment rate of their white counterparts, among the widest gaps in the nation. Experts say construction employment both reflects those differences and represents a potential solution, offering an entry-level opening to good-paying careers. Again, Calvin Littlejohn.
So I see it every single day. Personally, I live in North Minneapolis, so I personally have a charge to make sure that construction as a whole really does start to reflect the overall demographics that represents our community.
His company is already doing project management along with its much larger partner, Ryan. The two teamed up to win the bid to build the new 7,000-seat ballpark in downtown St. Paul. The city of St. Paul said today that work for minorities and women will be built right into the project, with a plan to have a 32% minority and 6% female labor force on the project. Mayor Chris Coleman today kicked off what officials described as a 2-year recruiting and training effort to build up a workforce to do the job. It will include a web-based clearinghouse and job fairs near the worksite.
$4 million worth of wages will be paid on this project alone, averaging on a scale of about $48 an hour. That's the kind of wage that you can raise a family on. And that's why it is so critically important that we make sure that the people that are working on this project reflect our community.
City officials say the plan is based on binding goals written into St. Paul ordinances. Those benchmarks also match goals for a much larger project, the $1 billion Viking Stadium, set to break ground in Minneapolis this fall.
That's Tim Nelson in St. Paul. Light rail planners are no closer to resolving a major design standoff along the Southwest Corridor. A key advisory board met yesterday to talk about ways to move the project forward. But as Laura Ewan reports, the controversy over how to make room for both light rail and freight rail in Minneapolis is leading to more unanswered questions.
The Southwest Corridor Management Committee is like a who's who of elected officials along the 15-mile route connecting Minneapolis to Eden Prairie. The board includes mayors, city council members, county commissioners, and others representing the five cities touching the line. They're charged with making key recommendations to the Metropolitan Council. The project's stickiest point remains what to do with freight rail traffic in the scenic Kenilworth Corridor of Minneapolis, which is popular with bicyclists. Hennepin County Commissioner Gail Dorfman sits on the advisory panel and says she hopes the freight rail impasse doesn't derail the whole project.
And so that's the issue that needs to be resolved and that we've been unable to do thus far.
After hearing community feedback in recent weeks, the Met Council staff has essentially whittled eight potential solutions to three. Two of the proposals call for light rail tunnels that would keep the freight rail traffic where it is. The third would send the freight trains through St. Louis Park. Some Minneapolis residents are fighting what they believe will be a constant crush of light rail trains in Kenilworth. St. Louis Park residents oppose increased freight traffic, saying it will require two-story berms that will divide their community. The management committee was expected to recommend one of the three options next Tuesday, but many members today said they needed more information and more time to digest it all. One concern is the ever-escalating price tag. The new estimates for the project range from about $1.58 billion to $1.82 billion, in part to reflect the freight rail changes. That's up from the original projection of $1.25 billion.
These are big numbers.
Hennepin County Commissioner Peter McLaughlin chairs a transit board encompassing five metro counties that will pay for 30% of the project's costs. He says the other counties are going to find it tough to swallow the rising dollar figures.
The concerns across the region are that if there is a major increase in cost, that it's going to get in the way of other priorities in the region. And so I think we have to be very cognizant of the cost increases and try to keep this thing under control.
Easily the most expensive option is a light rail subway tunnel, which would cost about $330 million. That's a concern to Met Council Chair Sue Haig, who says the proposal to build a shallower tunnel appears to be more viable.
And the deep tunnel option isn't off the table yet, of course, because this group has not made their recommendation, and it's still under consideration, but we can see that those are pretty expensive costs there.
Haig says she's encouraged that members of the management committee want to move forward, despite their growing list of questions. Project staff will brief them next week on how the proposals will affect the nearby lakes, their impact on ridership, and other matters. The panel could make its recommendation as early as August 28th, with the Met Council making an official decision sometime after that.
Laura Ewan on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. MinSure will ask the federal government for a total of $55 million to help fund the online insurance marketplace next year. Elizabeth Stawicki has a report.
The request is larger than the $40 million previously reported, in part because the state is seeking a financial buffer against unexpected costs. The request includes $45 million for operating costs, such as compensation for at least 165 full-time employees, information technology, customer service, and marketing. Executive Director April Todd Malmlof says an additional $10 million would be billed to the feds as an information technology expense for including Medicaid on the state's online insurance exchange.
Medicaid agencies are able to get a 90% federal match on IT services that are related to exchanges.
Minnesota has already received about $110 million in federal money to design and create the state's exchange, which is called MinSure. Elizabeth Stawicki, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Gaps in medical care can be expensive. The Minnesota Department of Human Services asked for ideas that could solve some of those gaps to help elderly patients stay at home. State grants are giving the best gap filler solutions a chance to prove themselves. Sometimes simple solutions are the best. As Dan Gunderson found, a program in Fergus Falls is proving the point.
Medication mistakes are a common reason people end up in the hospital or the doctor's office. Martha Hitzman is legally blind and is sometimes forgetful. She needs medication for pain and to prevent strokes. Marie Fox manages her 87-year-old mother's medication.
She was starting to miss doses, sometimes maybe four doses or five doses in 10 days. So I knew that she wasn't getting the medication that she needed.
Last August, Fox signed up for the MedSmart pilot project through a Fergus Falls long-term care facility. Her mother now has a small device on her kitchen table that holds 2 weeks' worth of medication. Hitzman says twice a day it beeps and it keeps beeping until it's tipped over and the pills are dispensed.
When I hear it ringing, I do what I need to do and take my time getting out here if I need to, because it will ring until I get here. It's really, really a wonderful convenience.
The device is connected to a phone line, and if it isn't tipped over within an hour, Marie Fox will get a text message.
I was able to take a week vacation last fall and not worry about her taking her meds every day. It gives her the independence and gives me the peace of mind that she's getting what she needs.
The MedSmart program costs $39 a month. A pilot project found this device reduced medication errors for most participants. Todd Johnson is a pharmacist at Lake Region Healthcare in Fergus Falls. He says the device won't help everyone. A medical team needs to decide who will benefit from this medication reminder. Some people are referred to other services. But Johnson says the project is filling a need in the community.
I know there's a case or two where family members have said, you've pretty much allowed my family member to maintain independent living when they weren't able to do that before. Non-compliance, especially with chronic disease medications, or just not taking them properly or running out of them, is a major cause of readmissions and clinic visits.
There are a number of devices on the market that dispense medication, but Pioneer Care Director of Home and Community Services Karen Wolfkuhl says what makes this project unique is that it's not just about technology. It's a local team of health professionals deciding on the best solution for individual patients. Wolfkuhl is trying to convince insurance providers to pay for the medication reminder. She says it's not unusual for insurance to pay hundreds of dollars a month for the drugs a patient needs.
The argument is, how valuable is that medication if they're not taking it? A $39 a month charge for a machine that helps support their health. That makes sense to cover that expense if in return it's going to keep them out of the hospital and then they won't be spending more money on an acute hospitalization.
Wolfkuhl says this project got off the ground with a $117,000 matching grant from the Minnesota Department of Human Services. It's one of 400 grants awarded since 2003 to help fix health care gaps for the elderly, according to Aging and Adult Services Director Jean Wood.
Minnesota has been very intent and very purposeful about wanting to make sure that people, wherever they live in the state, can stay home and be served through home and community-based services.
Wood says grant projects are tracked for 5 years, and more than 90% become self-sustaining. Other Minnesota communities are implementing the Fergus Falls-based Drug Reminder Program because they've identified the same medical service gap.
Dan Gunderson there in Fergus Falls. Football fans are gearing up for the Vikings' first preseason game tomorrow night. Among the retired purple jerseys hanging in the Metrodome is the number 80 of Chris Carter. Carter was inducted into the NFL Hall of Fame last weekend, and during his speech, the legendary receiver had a few words for Vikings fans and former teammates.
Minnesota Vikings fans, there was never a time in Minnesota I felt uncomfortable. And you guys showed me what it meant to be a pro. And you guys helped me in the transition. You knew I had tremendous issues, but you never held that against me. And I appreciate it that now I stand here with you, and I'm forever indebted to you.
Chris Carter spoke with our Stephen John on All Things Considered.
Chris Carter is the Vikings' all-time leading wide receiver, an 8-time Pro Bowler and member of the NFL's All-Decade team for the 1990s. These days, he's an analyst for ESPN and co-author of a new book, Going Deep, How Wide Receivers Became the Most Compelling Figures in Pro Sports. And he joins me now to talk about it. First of all, congratulations, Chris, on making it into the Hall of Fame.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and thanks for having me on the show.
You had expressed frustrations prior to your selection that maybe the wide receiver position didn't get the credit it deserves from Hall of Fame voters. Is that part of the reason you decided to write the book?
No, I didn't write the book for that. It had nothing to do with the Hall of Fame and the voters. I just wrote the book because someone had approached me with the idea that, Chris, you say things about wide receivers that I've never heard before. And I think that looking through the material, they did the research, and it was like, there's not a lot of material out there on wide receivers.
What are some of those different things that you were saying about wide receivers?
Well, just about their personalities. That's one thing. It's easier to understand them if you understand the type of kids that are going to try to play the position. That's a type A personality, Typically, for someone that's going to be very, very selfish. Typically, someone high-strung. Typically, someone that will be vocal. That, so if they're disappointed, they will say it. Because of their selfishness, too, they might try to generate more interest in themselves. I think that leads to some of the things that we've seen wide receivers do on and off the field.
Good and bad?
Well, absolutely. If they're going to try to generate attention for themselves, you know, as a player, then off the field, given all the new opportunities, they're going to try to cash in on that from a media standpoint, from a visibility standpoint, a way that they can stand out. And at their core, you know, they are entertainers, mm-hmm. and they understand that. And they will do things to make sure that people are understand their talent, and they're not afraid to tell people that they're good.
The subtitle of the book is How Wide Receivers Became the Most Compelling Figures in Pro Sports. What have you heard from your old quarterback and running back friends about that claim?
I could care less what they say. I'm writing about wide receivers. What would I care? I mean, Joe Montana could tell me what he – Joe Montana is not Joe Montana without Jerry Rice. Okay? Even when Joe Namath, the biggest game in NFL history, when he predicted all that, he knew he had a bunch of guys he could throw the ball to. Also, they could run the ball to. So you need wide receivers in this game, the NFL. In the past, it wasn't necessarily, but right now, it's a necessary evil.
So what has happened in the game of football in the NFL in the past, say, 25 years that has led to wide receivers becoming such an integral part of the offense?
Well, the rules have changed. They opened the game up. You know, you can't bump guys after 5 yards. And we have had, like never before, quarterbacks come into the league who are capable of throwing the ball, you know, all over the field. Formation changes. No, a pro set now is not a fullback, a tailback, a tight end, and two wide receivers. Man, a pro set is one tailback, one tight end, and three wide receivers. That is the standard NFL offense now.
Chris Carter, your old team's offense is centered these days on the talents of MVP running back Adrian Peterson. What do you think of the offseason moves the Vikings made to beef up their receiving game?
They've made a great additions. The rock of their passing game is going to be Greg Jennings. I know Greg very well. Been talking to him for a long time. Once free agency opened, I knew that we would have a shot to sign him. And you're able to take a player off of your great rival in the Packers.
Chris Carter, how about a prediction on how you think your old team, the Purple, is going to do this year?
The Vikings got a good football team, and I like Leslie Frazier as a coach. You know, their receiving core, I don't know how good they're going to be. So it's kind of hard to predict. I believe they'll be in the playoffs. That receiving core, if you tell me how good they're going to be, then I'll tell you how far they can go in the playoffs.
All right. It's been a real pleasure talking with you today.
Oh, thank you, sir.
Chris Carter and Stephen John on ATC and on the NPR News Update. That's all for Thursday. Big John has the Friday podcast. I'm Phil Picardi. You can find me tomorrow on the Daily Circuit on the radio.